Welcome to the NDTI podcast series, Talking Inclusion. My name's Drew Edwards, and today I'm joined by Jackie Shainitzer, Julie Poynter, and Raj Singh to talk about what it takes to be a leader for social inclusion in our communities and public systems. Welcome. If I could start by asking you just to introduce yourselves and explain a little bit about what you do.
Thanks for having us on this, Drew. I'm Jackie Shainitzer, and I have worked with NDTI for, I'm going into my fourth year now, and I work as an associate, and I've got a background in leadership development, occupational psychology and coaching. But in essence, my work is about helping people be happier and braver and feel like they belong in the workplace.
Hi Drew, hi Jackie. I'm Julie Poynter. My title is the Children and Young People Programme Lead for NDTI. My background though is social work actually. I've been a kind of children's and adults practitioner, I guess, for many years. And my role at NDTI is overseeing the Children and Young People's Programme.
Hello, I am Raj Singh and I'm a director for Social First Aid CIC. And I'm also an associate for NDTI, and I've been working around community-led support for around about 7 years now. So anything to do with community, and I like to be involved.
So we've got a really big subject here about leadership and social inclusion. If I could come to you first, please, Julie, and ask for your thoughts.
I think for me, from the wider question perspective, and Jackie mentioned this word as well, it is about courage, actually, because often courage was one of the things I think it's hard to have it all the time, but when you're looking at something that makes you stick your head up, you have to be really courageous. So I think courage is the one thing that sticks out for me straight away.
I'd go with Jules on the courage thing. Who we are is how we lead. If we want leaders to be compassionate, brave, know what they stand for, using their voices even when their knees are shaking, being able to go back and put things right where things need to be put right, being able to say I don't know, they're all things that can be learned, and I think we're not necessarily taught those things. So for me, it takes a leader to understand themselves and the humans around them. Conversations about power, who has power, who feels personally powerful, what happens when power feels unequal. To really understand those things requires really tough conversations. So I think it requires our leaders to be human, full of humanity and full of compassion. And that's I think there's an inner journey to go through with that.
And Raj, what would you add to that?
A thick skin. It's the fact that you are going to have good days and bad days on this journey. And I have plenty of them. And the good days are where you have that real, this is what it's about. This is it. This is a person thriving. And all the cogs in the system have cooperated at the very least. And the thick skin bit is about there are times when you don't get that and you get negative responses. And, you know, especially where I worked in the third sector, if I experience those kind of views in the third sector, of course, then I get even more grumpy because I think what's the third sector about? I thought we were supposed to be the antidote to part of this problem. Where the state is very rigid and formulaic about inclusion, guess who commissions the third sector? Oh, it's the state. So who is designing the contract specification? Who is managing the third sector contracts? You see, and how are they going to manage? They're going to manage in the style that they know and that they deal with on a daily basis. So then what happens is, if you're a third sector organisation, you then mimic the state, because that gives you an easy ride, really. And not only easy ride, you'll get plaudits for that. And the only antidote to those low points is seeing those outcomes and speaking to individuals on the ground. So anytime I've got a low point, I get out and speak to people on the ground. You have to have a balance, because you can't become that unpopular by simply getting a sledgehammer out every time something doesn't fit with the inclusion agenda. But it's this critical friend business. So that's what I learned early on in my career anyway, is be a critical friend. And so that term and that phrase, you got to really think about that, because it really takes something to tell the truth and tell people how it is, but to do it in a friendly way and to say, look, I am with you on this. So it's not just that I'm telling you that I'm a part of the solution as well, so I'll help you. It's not all about towing the line of whatever the latest state agenda is. And on the other hand, it's not that I'm just walking in with the placards to my local NHS CCG or local authority. That's not going to work either.
So not just a thick skin, but that sounds like you're also talking about bravery and courageousness as well, Raj. Is courageousness and bravery particularly pertinent at the moment, post-pandemic, for leaders and social inclusion?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I mean, particularly if we're thinking of the world of children and young people with additional needs, I feel we've moved. It's that feeling that you're almost having to buck against the trend now if you're a leader that's really pushing to ensure that those children and young people within your own localities are included in every walk of life. We kind of measure things, maybe we've always measured things in this way, but I get a real sense that we do a lot of measuring what I would call otherness. People who have a particular label are seen as other.
I think there is a global shift right now. The focus of the last year has really been about anti-racism conversations. And so for leaders to be able to be brave about conversations that are tough, even when you don't have the language ready or right, or you might offend someone, or something needs to be talked about, but actually it's really difficult to find the words to address it in a way that is inclusive, where you might be messy about it because we want it to be all tied up in a bow before we even have a go at it, and that's not possible. So we need to be better at being with the discomfort of it. But I think there's an opportunity because there's a global, there's so much coming up right now. You don't need me telling you, people listening to this won't need to be told. There's a lot of stuff coming out of the shadows so that we can look at it and decide together, that's not what we want, this is what we want. And I think our job is to help for me personally to do it, I have to do it myself, but also to help others turn towards the what is wanted, which is everyone belongs, everyone has value, everyone has a contribution to make, and how do we look towards that? Because we say that we do, and then there are, I can think of lots of times where I've made a judgment because that's human. So how do we resolve that inner separation first and the judgments we're making about ourselves and about other people, so that we can, when we look at another human, we're looking from a place of generosity and belonging, even if there are difficulties.
And that's really challenging for everybody. So how do you cope as a leader in that situation?
In terms of leadership, we need our own peer support network. I'm not talking about formulaic or anything. I'm talking about other people that get it, wherever they might be in the system, wherever they might be. And that, because we need to debrief as well, because we hear things, see things that we don't like, don't support inclusion. And in fact, I see many colleagues quite regularly that question why they're in the profession that they're in all the time. And so we've got to talk those colleagues down and just talk the problem out and share it. And so that's another key part of, I think, of leadership, is having that network. And it's not about big numbers. Can be very few, but people that kind of really understand and will support you, and you do the same for them as well. I think that network is really important. Of course, what happens is someone will listen to this podcast and go, oh yes, right, so we need a inclusion leadership peer support forum network, and right, okay, so Drew's going to send the login out to everybody. Yeah, can you log in? Is everyone logged in now? Right, okay, yeah, log in. And what you can do, it's a great place, you just put what's in your head on there, and it's so brilliant. That sounds good. It personally, it's never kind of worked for me. So I'm just saying, avoid that. And someone, in case someone is thinking about commissioning some big 50 grand piece or something, because somebody will, I know you out there, somebody cheeky will be having a go. Don't do that. Let's not do that. But what I'll allow you to do is set up a WhatsApp group. There you go. I'll let you do that. That's free. It's not going to cost anything. And it'll probably go some of the way.
That's about trust, isn't it, Raj? That's about having a place where you feel safe and where you can talk to people. But it has to come in a trusting relationship with people.
So the SEND Leadership Programme is a really good example of that. The collective safety that gets created for people to feel that relationship happens, and so people trust, and then they get to be who they are, and then they go and do amazing things in the places where they are because they know what's needed.
I think for a lot of us, and I think this is true of leaders in general, we kind of stumble across leadership. You know, we are in a role, and then that gets, you know, we get the promotion, and then maybe we get another promotion, and often it is a stumbling. And I think for the leaders that we have on the program, and certainly for me as a leader now, you have to sometimes almost strip back and actually think about, you know, what is the true leader in me?
And is that something that you've both experienced on the SEND Leadership Programme?
So we've been working together, there's four of us, we've been working together for, I think, maybe five years now. And I'd like to think we try and really model good leadership. So we have each other's backs where, you know, it's not about you actually, and it's not about your ego. It's about the people that you're supporting, or you're trying something new. You're having the courage to try something new. You can do that because you know that there are people who've got your back.
How do you think inclusion's been part of the strategy for out there in the community and what that means to the community?
It's a quiet leadership. So you look at the small scale stuff, it's a quiet, lethal leadership because it's so on the money. And I've talked about this one example of during the lockdown, where I talked about a sort of little library popping up on someone's house, right? So I tell that story, and I like to tell stories again because I normally think about them from different angles over time. So what happened there? In the village that we live in, the library, small offshoot library, was run by the local authority. So many years ago, there was cutbacks happening. People pushed back and said, we'll run it. Okay, brilliant. So, of course, volunteers came up, a structure was set up, and they offered to run it. During the pandemic, it was closed at the start of the pandemic. Just up until the start of the last summer holidays, which, of course, were a very worrying set of summer holidays, if you remember. It was a very uncertain time for parents. And so that wasn't open. Look at that. In terms of the asset transfer, this big state running it, then it's gone to a kind of third sector formal volunteers. And even that hasn't helped when it was required. Then what happened is just a member of the community, a young mother, asked a family member to put this sort of library thing up at the front of the house, put review forms in there, or sanitize. It was very, very well organized. And on top of that, like I said, a few times I'd walked past and noticed there's lots of cardboard knocking around. And I can say, what's going on here? And he said, oh, well, I'll send you a link to our Amazon page. Oh, right. And basically, people could remotely order a book and it would get delivered to this free library. So any supporters out there, and people were actively doing it. So it was so innovative, and it addressed such a problem where people were being excluded, a really rural community, and there was no other option. But look at the makeup of the individual that set that initiative up. A young mother with literally no time on her hands, literally. It's like four kids, no time on her hands at all. No time to sit in our drivel meetings that we have for hours on end and, oh, well, we must invite so-and-so, we must do. No, none of that. Only time just to get on with the job. And secondly, if she had any spare time, it would be to interact with the people that were taking avail of that offer. Right? So you can tell me. So if all you're surrounded by is the people that are using that and interacting with them, that's your sole focus. You're just going to get on with doing the job. So that's my kind of small. So that's quiet leadership, that is, you could say, isn't it?
So how do you overcome barriers to that as a leader?
It took me a long time to realise that the commonality of our work was about human belonging. And I know that I've had the experience of when I'm faced with difference, something happens inside me which has me not stay present and connected with the person in front of me. And I recognize that in myself in terms of disability, where I meet someone and I don't know how to be with them because I've never been taught, or I'm afraid I'm going to say and do the wrong things. And I recognize that in myself in other places, conversations about race or gender, using language, like, you know, having a room full of leaders and from different cultures or different organizations. When I meet someone and I don't understand what they're saying, what happens in me, and how does that get in the way of connection and collaboration, and how do I other them and exclude them internally as I'm relating with them? Because that's the starting point, I think.
As individuals, if we can open up our own barriers, then we're moving in the right direction to collectively open up the barriers that are there for everybody, to an inclusive society and a community. We want to be in our community. We want to be doing something that makes us feel worthwhile. You know, we'd like to be as independent as we can be. So I think often it is for us, or certainly for me as a leader, it's reminding people what community is, particularly now post-COVID. You know, we saw two sides of a coin, didn't we? I think we saw a lot of loneliness and isolation, but we also saw a lot of communities pulling together big time, actually without the involvement of the state, in inverted commas. They just got on and did it.
So we ran a new directors program. And I remember hearing one of the aspiring or new directors say, do you know what? It's easier to be brave during a pandemic, because we haven't got time to mess around with the bureaucracy. So the things that are, I think there's something about the certainty and safety that people want. And we've always done it that. We all know that, you know, we've always done it this way. Why does it need to change? We cling to old things. But I think what I've seen people do is recognize what the barrier is and then just trash through it in service of what needs to happen for people and families. Even if it's scary, even if it's unknown, even if we've never done it, even if someone's going to be in trouble, even if we don't meet the figures. Having said that, I'm also aware that one of the barriers I think we see, and I see it in the SEND workforce, and it's different in the adult social care workforce, it's different in health, is this sense of agency. Am I able to affect change in the role that I'm in and with my own personal sense of power? Because I think someone who's at the top of a hierarchy in an organisation has autonomy, authority and agency, the ability to make stuff happen. And not all of the people that we work with feel personally able to have that agency to affect change. So I think that's a barrier. And if I want to affect change, I'm probably going to have to stretch and make something happen.
So we've talked a lot about the individual attributes of a leadership. How have you seen people work together collaboratively to affect change in the community?
In terms of collaboration on the ground, number one with the communities, it is about trust. The trust is the bedrock of everything. So it's trusting what they say when they tell you what they need. That's really important. And secondly, back to the critical friend bit, giving the pushback where we encounter things that don't sit well with our inclusion type agenda and movement. Because you will encounter those things. I have all the time. And, you know, sometimes it's not about actually, if someone's running something and it's not quite, you know, it's not quite inclusive or as we would view it. It might be that that person just lacks confidence, they haven't got the awareness, or they may not be the right person, but communities are abundant, have lots of different people, and we can draw upon other skills there. So we have in communities people that we call the change makers, I call them, and they are these quiet leaders, etc., etc., and they are there. And I think it's about not forcing them to collaborate where it's not a good fit for them. If it's not, let them create their own network and circle, which they do quite successfully. So I think it's that. And because we'll be working with a state agenda, third sector agenda, there might be a pot of money that's to be unlocked because we all get together and do all of this. And then we try to force, you know, these leaders into boxes, etc. So it's just definitely don't do that. Steer clear of that, I would say. That's a key thing around collaboration. But I keep on coming back to trust, because some of the collaborations around the pandemic, would be heavily mistrusted by the state, to be honest. You know, where you were delivering supplies and goods and things like that, and you weren't relying on having comprehensive lists with NHS numbers and national insurance numbers to verify and cross-reference. When you're on the ground in the community, you hear things. So if you're embedded, you'll get that feedback. If you're sat in an office somewhere, or you're not actually operating in the community, you're just operating on paper, you know, a community setting, for example. A lovely word, isn't it? It's just a clinical setting dumped in the middle of a community. So what I hear in the state is, well, as soon as they get this conversation, they'll say, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, we absolutely do that. We keep the community at arm's length. And I'll say, arm's length? You do that with someone you don't like. Have them next to you. Don't keep them at arm's length. If someone said, Raj, yeah, you're doing a really good job, so we're going to keep you at arm's length, I'd be upset about yeah. that. Let's not do that. Let's not keep them at arm's length. Let's keep them here next to us.
If I think about some of the teams that I've kind of seen over the years, the best teams are the collaborative teams, where they'll look at what needs to be done and then they'll work out who's the best person to do it, who's got the best skills to do this. So not you because you're a social worker, or you because you're a health visitor, or you because you're a teacher. How can we work together as a team around this family to actually create change and provide them with what they need to move forward? Who's got the best skills to do that?
For leaders and for leading social inclusion change, what do we still need to do?
I think we need to go back to basics. We need to remember to put the voice of the people that we're serving at the heart of the conversations and the plans that we are doing. And that means on the ground for individuals and families, but also strategically for any plans and developments that you're making as a leader within your local area. Engage your local community. I mean, how many times have we been in situations where we've seen things created, developed and built and not had the voice of the people who are going to use those services? And what a surprise when we realise that it's not fit for purpose, or it doesn't do what people need it to do. But also look at what's there already. Look at the community. We do, Drew, when we were meeting face to face, so many days where we'll do a vision with the local area around, you know, you've got young people coming through. You want them to have gloriously ordinary lives. What's your collective vision? What does that look like for you? And then we ask, you know, under those kind of four PFA headings, what have you got already? What's here? What's happening? What's working? What's not working? Every time we do it, we have within the room, people say, well, I had no idea we had that service.
And I would say that what there is still to do is, two main things that occur to me. To get better at having hard conversations that lead us to greater connection. And I think we need to learn to rest. And it's a curveball, isn't it? I think our workforce are exhausted. Mm-hmm. And people have been in this like surge capacity. So the body goes into this freaking out with an emergency situation. But we've had that chronically now for 18 months or so. People are not rested. People are exhausted. Generally, I think even before pandemic, this sense of keep going, keep producing, keep efforting, a rested leader is one that's going to make good choices and is going to come from a deeper place inside than a scattered, tired, keeping going kind of place.
There's lots to do. So what should we do now, I suppose, is probably helpful start. So we know we've been through everything in the pandemic, etc., and it has uncovered some of the new leadership, I would say. And I think it's about nurturing that new leadership. Because as we've seen, some of the traditional setups and services, etc., didn't respond well to the pandemic. It's not a criticism of them, because there were some very serious reasons why some of them couldn't. For example, we talked about vulnerabilities a little bit, but in the government definition of vulnerability and the vulnerable lists, the wholesale lists that were going around, they cut swathes of our voluntary sector out and kept them under house arrest for quite some time. So we've got some people that kind of were very active and perhaps now less so, and, you know, they're having to make their own life decisions about what they feel comfortable about doing. But we've got lots of green shoots coming at the other end from the COVID mutual aid type stuff. And it's going to take some real skill to do that.
So skill, trust and courage, those are the things that we've talked about. And it's such a big subject, but we're out of time, I'm afraid. So thank you for joining us. And we hope that you can listen again to our next episode.